Welcome to the 41st episode of Metacode Talks. This is a very special edition today with Brad Garlinghouse joining us. Brad is the CEO of Ripple, a leading enterprise blockchain solutions company, and also now the owner of Metacode since May this year. Brad, welcome to Metacode Talks.
Thank you. Glad to know I'm the 41st.
I think it's a good number. So let me start with the question that I guess every single interviewer asks you to start with. You know, we've had very good updates on the status with the American regulators lately. You know, XRP is in and of itself not a security. Can you give us more context? What does it mean? What does it imply for Ripple as a whole?
You know, the macro dynamic in the United States obviously has been frustrating for companies in the U.S., companies wanting to operate in the U.S. And Ripple was kind of at the front end of that with the United States Securities Exchange Commission filing a lawsuit almost 3 years ago now, asserting that Ripple's sales of XRP had been the sale of unregistered securities. So our lawsuit win, which I think also around the same time was an important win in the U.S. courts for a lawsuit around a company called Grayscale, it really, I think, has shown that the chairman of the SEC, a gentleman named Gary Gensler, has, I think, had a failed policy of how do we regulate through enforcement. And you know, that hasn't been effective. It hasn't worked. The courts have now moved against the SEC, and we're, I hope, entering a new age where we can actually have clear policy that is constructive in the United States. And as you said, Adrian, what the judge in our case said, XRP in and of itself is not a security. So now almost, you know, in an unhealthy way, the only two things that, the only two digital assets in the United States that are clear, there's clarity, they're not a security, is XRP and Bitcoin. And the SEC has continued to kind of, I think, muddy the waters around lots of other things. So creating that confusion, I think, actually has helped the SEC try to retain power, because you know, one of the things I tweeted out a while ago is the idea that confusion masquerades as power. If it's clear, the SEC doesn't have authority because these aren't securities. They're the Securities Exchange Commission. So I'm super pleased about it. I think it is creating some momentum in the legislature of the United States to create that clarity. But as you know, Adrian, really well, and I think, well, certainly a lot of your customers and prospects know, outside the United States, there's been much more clarity, and that has allowed Ripple to grow. 88% of our hiring in Q3 was outside the United States, in places like London and Switzerland and Singapore and Dubai. And that's largely because there has been that clarity. So I'm really pleased about the case. I'm really pleased that we won on everything that matters. But I still think the U.S. is not yet in a, I guess, called constructive place in terms of what the future of crypto looks like in the United States.
That's super interesting. And one thing is that this discussion with the regulators also emphasize a lot the XRP and XRPL component of Ripple. I'll be honest with you, Brad, until very recently, I always thought Ripple was actually everything about XRPL and XRP. I thought it was a cryptocurrency. I didn't realize that there was all of this business, which was almost a software and financial service, regulated financial service business. Can you tell us a little bit more about what Ripple is doing beyond the distributed ledger and the cryptocurrency?
Yeah, I think it's a really important distinction that there are always, well, I've been in the company now 8.5 years, almost 9 years, and I think there's always been this kind of conflation and confusion between what is Ripple and what is XRP. And I think you understand well, and I think many people are starting to understand better, that you know, XRP is an open source digital asset that anyone can participate in that ecosystem. The code is not controlled by Ripple. The validator network is not controlled by Ripple. We're clearly an interested party in that. We own a lot of XRP, and we think XRP is extremely efficient for many use cases. Not all use cases. We definitely are not maximalists in that we think that there's a place for Bitcoin. There's a place for a lot of other tokens and different use cases. But you know, Ripple at its core is an enterprise infrastructure company focused on blockchain. We started with a use case around payments. We have now expanded beyond that. We introduced a product prior to the Metacode acquisition called Liquidity Hub, focused on managing and sourcing liquidity across the digital asset ecosystem. with the Medico acquisition earlier this year. We're obviously expanding to custody. And we see ourselves expanding to other use cases focused on that infrastructure side at the enterprise level, really going after financial institutions, enterprises. And you know, we're really pleased about where we sit there. We certainly think we have a ways to go. But I think going back to your core question, there were a lot of people who I think just didn't understand that Ripple is not XRP and XRP is not Ripple. And that's partly because, you know, exchanges would list, you know, XRP as Ripple. And people say, oh, I bought some Ripple. I'm like, no.
I used to say this.
Yeah. And so it's been something that we have combated for a long time and will continue to do so. And just, you know, providing education about what Ripple is doing. As you said, Ripple is clearly, if not the leading enterprise infrastructure company around blockchain. We're one of them. And so we're really pleased about that momentum. And we're glad to have Medico as part of that family.
Well, speaking about Medico, so you acquired as a company Medico and you're the sole owner today. It's obviously a very different kind of business, at least in appearance. You know, we and I say we because, you know, I used to be the founder and CEO. I'm still the CEO. So Medico was focused on purely the infrastructure, selling custody mainly to the banking institutions. Obviously, Ripple is doing more than this. How do you see the two combining together and creating synergies, creating value?
So look, I think there is customer overlap in that, you know, Ripple has a broad sales force as well as existing customer base of financial institutions. Medico, as you know better than me, has tended to play at the tier one level. Ripple has tended to play below the tier one level. But I think there's clearly overlap there that has created some positive synergy. I also think as you look at where the product suite, the opportunity for financial institutions broadly is going, it doesn't stop with custody. It doesn't stop with payments. And so it's really, you know, how do different banks, different financial institutions take advantage of a suite of products that would include custody, that could include payments, that could include other capabilities at the infrastructure kind of enterprise level. Now, you know better than anyone, and certainly the Medico team, which really just achieved an immense amount of success with a pretty small, lean team and competed very effectively against larger, better funded companies. But you know, the macro environment around custody digital assets is expected to be close to $10 trillion by the year 2030. And inevitably, people are going to need a place to store those assets and safe, secure, and they're going to need to be able to transfer them as well, having good on and off ramps, even a tokenization engine, some of the work Ripple is doing around central bank digital currencies or CBDCs. So we think there's a lot of pieces that come together. And we already had, and I remember when you and I first spoke, you know, I remember being on a call with one of the largest top 10 banks in the world, and a bank Ripple was already working with, and they were asking us about, could we help them with their custody? This is prior to the Medico acquisition. And we weren't in a position to do that. And so when we think about that synergy, the ability to say to that existing Ripple customer, hey, you know, here's a best in class, you know, going head to head time and time again and winning on the custody level, you know, to be able to bring that product to them, I think is a great opportunity for the two companies together. So, you know, I'm really happy about it. I'm curious, you know, if I can turn the tables for a moment, what has been your experience about the synergies as you've been, you know, you've only been here a few months as inside Ripple, but I'm curious what you have seen so far.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I'm going to be very honest here. I think we've been very good at one thing at Medico, which was focus. You know, we've specialized in doing infrastructure, in building security-related software. And we've done it very well. And we've also specialized in our go-to-market into the larger segment of the banking sector. But it was also our weakness, you know, in a sense, because we became so specialized that it became hard for us to emerge beyond infrastructure, if you wish. So we were probably the best at infrastructure. But then getting into the use cases, you know, starting to think, you know, I'm gonna be processing payments. I'm going to be tokenizing real assets. I'm going to create value that the banks can truly leverage in and of themselves, what was becoming harder and harder because our team and our go-to-market was specialized on infrastructure. And I think what we're seeing in the collaboration with Ripple is that we are starting to be able to combine this deep expertise in infrastructure and security that Medaco has acquired, also the network and the success we have on the market with now value-added services, which potentially can leverage also the different licenses that you have as a regulated financial institution, and start selling more vertical offerings that go beyond the pure infrastructure level. So I think that's probably what excites me the most, is that Medaco in itself still exists as it used to be. It's still largely independent, still has its same exact offering with its same ambitions, but it's now able to provide more value to the clients.
Well, one thing you said it really resonates with me that I think has been important, both in it's not actually a go-to-market synergy, but I think both Medaco and Ripple came from the point of view that regulatory frameworks matter, that compliance matters. And I think in the crypto space, for better or for worse, and in many cases for worse, a lot of players in the crypto space have come from a kind of anti-government, oftentimes, frankly, anti-bank point of view. And I think from the earliest days, Ripple took this point of view that, like, if we want these technologies to have the biggest impact for the largest set of populations to benefit from these technologies, we needed to work with the system. We needed to work with governments and with banks. And, when Ripple has looked at acquisitions over the years, I mean, really, Medaco, for all intents and purposes, is the first acquisition we've ever made. And, for a company in Silicon Valley, kind of 10 years into our history to make our first acquisition, that I think we've been patient. And I think part of that is because we wanted to find the right fit, and that meant culturally, from a product strategy point of view. And then, but part of that culture is, as I was just saying, the regulatory posture of kind of respecting that regulations matter globally and leaning into the right kind of licensing, I think, is an area where Medaco and Ripple really saw eye to eye early on. And I think that has served both companies well. And I think, by bringing the two companies together and having Ripple's invested a lot in licensing around the world, we just got our major institutional payments license in Singapore just a month or so ago. And so, we'll continue to lean into that. But I think that part of that cultural fit between Ripple and Medaco is super important to getting a deal done.
I completely agree. I would actually say that the interesting thing of capitalism is that even if you don't truly enjoy everything that comes with regulators and all of the rules and potentially the frictions in developing, if you just look at where the opportunity is, it creates a strong incentive for you to build a business which is going to be aligned with the current frameworks. And whether it's good or bad is, a question of opinion, and it can be a question of politics. But the reality is when Medaco was founded, we were not so much about, is it good or bad that regulators exist? We took the current state of affairs, which was regulators are here. There are massive banks on the market which are managing trillions of dollars worth of assets. At some point, cryptocurrencies and tokenized assets are going to be so big that they will not be in the hands of the retail consumers in their mobile phones, but they will have to be re-centralized in more professional companies that are subject to regulations. Again, whether they like it or not, because there is a top-down push by governments and regulators. And therefore, the opportunity became obvious that there was a need to build such institutional infrastructure. It brings me to the future. So, Brad, I mean, I think Ripple has a culture of being very transparent, both internally as a company, but also to the markets in how it communicates about its ambitions. I think Medaco maybe a little bit less, because we tend to be very conservative with, clients that don't like us to be too transparent. But can you tell us a bit more about the future plans of the company, where you see the company in Q4 and next year, both in terms of product, if you have something to say, or in terms of general trajectory?
Yeah. So first, I want to comment briefly. Your comment about transparency, I think, is an important one, because I think particularly in a new category like crypto, you're still building trust. You're still building. People don't know how to think about. And frankly, look, to speak freely, there have been some bad actors, right? I think we're all to varying degrees paying attention to the headlines of a interesting trial going on in New York right now with Sam Bankman-Fried. And I think when you do have new technologies and people are trying to figure out how do they take advantage of those to benefit their customers or improve efficiency in their technology, like you have to build trust. And one of the key things in my lifetime that has built trust, and I mean this on a personal and professional basis, is transparency. And I think Ripple early on decided to, really, we did these things called XRP markets reports once a quarter. And we would publish, and this is dating all the way back to, I think, 2016 or 2017, at a time when a lot of people were very secretive about what was going on in crypto and what how much crypto they owned and what they were doing with it. And we decided to kind of buck that trend and be very transparent. Now, ironically, I think that's one of the things that hurt us in the SEC. If people say, why did the SEC go after Ripple? And I think it's partly because we gave them all the information to do so, which felt not so great, ironic in its certain ways. But I still stand by the, like, if you want to build trust in new technologies, you want to build trust in new products, you want to build trust in new companies like Ripple and Medico, then you have to be transparent. You have to, you know, go above and beyond. And certainly, we have tried to do that.
So maybe before you go to the company strategy, speaking about trust, do you think there is a future where trust, the concept of trust can be mostly eliminated because you can essentially trust the infrastructure itself? You know, when we speak about blockchain, we in fact speak of trustless technology because you don't need to trust the legal system. You don't need to trust the counterparty. You can observe everything and it's secured by mathematics and algorithmics. So can you see a future where your statement is actually proven wrong and you no longer need to trust something in somebody?
You know, I am not enough of a fortune teller and future seeker. I think some of those things to me, and you know, like I'm one person, some of those things to me feel philosophical or academic and not pragmatic. And, you know, I can get my head around like, oh yeah, oh, that's interesting. Like that would be interesting. But a lot of times when I read papers on the, and I read the, you know, people, companies are building around that, I think, well, wait a minute. That's not the world we live in today. And the world we live in today, you do have counterparties. You do have regulations. You do have compliance. And could that world exist, or could a subset of our economy, you know, in a parallel structure work that way? Maybe. I think I view myself more as a pragmatist, that some of those things feel more academic and philosophical than they do feel like, okay, that really can roll out at scale and benefit millions or frankly billions of customers. You know, one of the promises of crypto and blockchain was to bring some of the underbanked or unbanked into the ecosystem. And I still very much believe that we haven't really achieved that. And I think in some ways it's because we jump to, well, we'd like the world to look like this. And you do get in the crypto space some, I don't know the word, but religiosity. Like people are guided by a philosophical view to, you know, such an extreme that you're just like, wait a minute, like that's not pragmatic. We're not going to actually be able to really move the ball forward. Again, I'm maybe pontificating and ranting a little bit here, but I'm a huge believer in the opportunity represented by crypto and blockchain. And I think sometimes the industry gets its own way by not being transparent and by unfortunately having people, you know, like Sam Bankman-Fried or even the Celsius meltdown last year. And, you know, those were, I mean, Celsius to some degree was intended to be one of those trustless, yield bearing. And, you know, for me, I looked at it, I didn't participate because I live by the adage, if something seems too good to be true, it probably is. And that one certainly felt that way. Anyway, I think I'm off track of your core question around Ripple's strategy. I'll pause there. Anything else around that you want to comment on, or can I?
Well, no, I think we can go back to the strategy if there is something that you'd like to share about the future of Ripple. Where are we going?
Yeah. Well, like, so now I commented a little bit of this earlier on. You know, at the core, Ripple really has been a software and blockchain business at its core. We are using blockchain digital assets to solve pain points. We started around moving money around the world. You know, we have this grand vision and ambition that we can enable an internet of value, that value can move the way information moves today. And, you know, I've used examples that it's just crazy that you can stream video from the space station. But, you know, for me to send, you know, I'm sitting in California today, and for me to send money into Swiss francs would be, you know, rather slow and rather expensive. And yet it's all just ones and zeros. It's all bits. And so, you know, why can't we not do that more efficiently? We started with payments, cross-border payments, because we felt like that was the highest friction point. But we've always had this grander ambition. And a couple times I've commented that, you know, for me, when I think about Amazon, the company today, you know, it started with just books. It was a bookseller. And I viewed Amazon is to books as Ripple is to cross-border payments. And what I mean by that is we do have ambitions beyond just cross-border payments to do payments more broadly, but also to really be that infrastructure, and thus the acquisition of Medico, thus the initiative around Liquidity Hub. We have some other initiatives we're working on, but when we think about that infrastructure layer and we think about, do we build that internally? You know, Ripple is about 1,000 people strong now. Do we build it? Do we buy it, as we've done it with the case of Medico, or do we partner and integrate? And you know, we want to be able to partner with banks and financial institutions and bring a kind of one-stop shop to solve some of the things they are dealing with as they think about how they can use these technologies and answer some of the answer some of the questions that customers are bringing to them today.
I'll share something which I rarely say openly, but many of the banks that we meet and some of the banks that we work with, they know they want to go into digital assets, but they don't know why. They don't know what they want to achieve. They don't know, they may know how they want to do it, but they don't know what's the end goal. And obviously, you are already somewhat closer to the end goal, providing regulated services. And it brings me to the question, do you feel that the current positioning of Ripple is to some extent competitive with some of the banks that as a group we are going after and we're collaborating with? Or do you see this as being more complementary or potentially completely different?
I mean, I see it as pretty different. You know, banks today, you know, we're not trying to take their customer. You know, we're trying to enable banks, frankly, to better serve those customers. And Adrian, I agree with something you said there, that I think a lot of people are interested in crypto. They're not 100% sure they know why. And they're getting customers of theirs who are interested in being able to use crypto for various things. I think one of the things we as an industry, and I mean the crypto and blockchain industry, I think we're still in the very early stages of going beyond what is just speculative use cases. And I think, you know, to really see the promise of crypto and blockchain, you know, at scale, it's not just about speculative use cases, whether that's on the enterprise side or the retail side. But in order to develop some of these non-speculative use cases, you also need that regulatory clarity. And again, you're seeing places like the EU and the UK and Singapore and Australia and UAE, you know, they have moved forward with various licensing regimes and rule books. And that has allowed people to start to think about, okay, how should I think about the tokenization of commercial real estate? By the way, that's not something, I'm just using that as an example. I don't want people to overread that, you know, the CEO of Ripple said, yeah, just, I think that's a real use case. That's not speculation. You know, how can the token, there's a lot of friction in some of these industries. And when you can, you know, make that simpler, either the transaction or in the ownership or custody, that I think is good for the global economy. And so I think you're seeing major financial firms start to lean in here in the United States, you know, even with the Bitcoin ETF. But, you know, I mean, Crédit Agricole in France, there's a number of big financial institutions starting to lean in and really think about not speculation, but okay, we can use these technologies to solve these problems in these ways. So I don't know if I exactly answered your question there, but you know, when I think about kind of where the world's going, I think, you know, I'm talking about SBF as not being good for crypto. I don't even think that the NFT, the non-fungible token craze around the speculation on some of the NFTs, I think was not actually good for the industry. I think it got a fervor of excitement, but actually, you know, okay, wait, what problem is that solving? Where is that really improving efficiency or what have you? And I think for a lot of that, I didn't see it.
Are you of those that believe that everything will be tokenized eventually? Do you see this $1,000 trillion worth of assets and potentially beyond what we today call assets, let's say the key to your car, the key to your door?
In general, I am very much a believer that tokenization is not a, you know, passing speculative opportunity. I think tokenization is very real. And I think it's hard for me to predict where that goes. So, you were kind of, there's a saying in Silicon Valley of, you know, people often overestimate the change that'll happen in 5 years, but grossly underestimate the change that'll happen in 10 years. So I think people have overestimated what's going to happen with tokenization in the short term, but I think they've underestimated grossly how tokenization may evolve in the next 10 to 20 years. So I think there's a lot of examples. I mean, you listed off some there that really would, I start with the efficiency. Is it solving a problem? And you know, some of the things you mentioned, I think that those are real opportunities to solve a problem. And therefore, I think someone will find ways to tokenize and bring that to market. But the challenge isn't, can you tokenize it? The challenge is, how do you make it useful? How do you take it to market? You know, I have been, I don't know that publicly vocal, but I've always been a little bit skeptical of the tokenization of identity. Now, on one hand, the benefit is real, right? We all in the financial services world deal with, you know, can you tokenize identity in a way that could make KYC much easier and make some of these kind of capabilities simpler? But I think that's an example to me where I could see tokenization making sense, but go to market around it is really tricky because you think about who owns your identity today, Adrian. You know, your passport's issued by a country, your birth certificate's issued by, you know, a county or a state or something, and your driver's license or what have you. Like, those are the acceptable legal forms of identity. They're all owned by a government in some way. And so to do that, I think you have to have government cooperation, which, you know, in the United States anyway, is our government's hard to get anything done. So I think some of those tokenization use cases you're describing, I think, are going to be kind of tricky.
Yeah, and you need an extreme degree of consensus and ecosystem, right? I mean, you think about tokenization today, on the short term, there is no obvious value on how to either decrease the costs or improve, you know, efficiency, because it's probably more expensive to operate a token than to operate in the traditional space with, you know, traditional frameworks. And it only truly materializes as a value when you end up having a number of the key players in this industry, the tier one, you know, custodian banks, the intermediaries, the transfer agents, etc., that all move to this new scheme and start essentially, potentially either making less mistakes, some of them could disappear in principle, and you have a single way of representing value. I think we're still far from it, and this is probably what's making so, which is slowing down this innovation. Now, taking this to back to Ripple, obviously there is a lot of speculation that payments is something that can go beyond, the traditional rails. There are other ways you could operate. You could operate potentially with tokens, with stable coins. Are you particularly interested in stable coins? Is it something that you see as being valuable in the future?
I mean, the short answer is yes. I think stable coins have a role to play because they are efficient. They are adding an efficiency to how money is moving today. And they are, back to my point around transparency, they are trusted in a way that people perceive crypto as less trustworthy in some ways because of volatility. Now, I'm not sure we have gotten to the promised land as it relates to stable coins. You know, that there are stable coins in the market today that have depegged, and, you know, some have recovered, some have at times a couple have gone away in effect. So I think we have to remember this whole industry is still pretty nascent, and I think it's going to continue to evolve. But I do believe that stable coins have a role to play. I'm bullish on that. You know, one manifestation of that is Ripple has invested and is working with about 10 different governments around the world to do central bank digital currencies. I mean, a central bank digital currency is a stable coin. It's just issued by the government. But I also think there'll be stable coins outside of that. But as we've already talked about, it's important, I think, to have clear regulatory guidelines as to how those will work, and to make sure they are safe for consumers, make sure they are safe for counterparties, you know, et cetera.
Thank you. So coming back,
I'm curious, by the way, Adrian, I'd love to hear your answer to that question. What's your take on the future of stablecoins?
Well, you know, I was actually curious about your response because, of course, Ripple has been very visible also on the CBDC space. It's clear that the technology of XRPL is something that can be used also in a more privatized, if I can call it this way, version of the ledger. It can be turned into a private payment platform or private transfer platform. XRP also in general is considered to be one of the best tokenization platforms. You know, it's very clean, very hot. It's meant for tokenization. It's meant also for on-chain trading. Actually, with features which came way before some of the more generic platforms such as Ethereum brought this concept of AMM, automated market making, etc. So my view is that, again, I have this sort of pragmatic view that something which is technically feasible will eventually happen. You know, it may take a long time, but it will eventually happen. And because it is possible for governments and central banks to eventually digitalize everything, even though it's not something they are comfortable with on the short term, simply because they've never done it, it's a very different role for them. I'm convinced that the attractiveness of being in control and having even more control and power and ability to enforce regulations is something that will make central banks, you know, move to market with some form, whether it's retail or wholesale, of CBDC. Now, what does it mean for private stablecoins? Where, first of all, until central banks are going at scale with CBDC, I think we're not there yet. You know, some central banks are now moving, and they are clear that they are going to this market, but it's going to take time until they are truly productive, and in particular for the main largest banks to be on the markets. And also because they are afraid of the implications of this. You know, what does it mean for the banking system? What does it mean for the monetary supply, the control of inflation, et cetera? It's not clear. And so I think until such central banks are, you know, moving at scale with CBDC, there is clearly a need to have a sort of proxy to the central bank money, which today is a private form of a stable coin. And there are indeed multiple initiatives on the market. Some of them have been more successful than others, have been able to better keep their peg. There are many shapes of them also. Some of them are more algorithmic. They try to maintain the peg through a sort of, you know, over-collateralization mechanism, which could be on-chain. They have tended to be sometimes less stable than the fully backed stable coins. I don't know how the market is going to evolve, but one thing is clear. I think there is a need today for the on-chain activity to grow for a stablecoin to exist.
I think that's well said. I agree.
Right. Coming to a different topic. So, you know, Ripple is also known to be very active on the market in terms of, you know, events, communication with its clients, with its partners. You have pretty soon an event called Swell, which is going to be taking place in Dubai. Do you want to say a few words about this?
Yeah, I appreciate that you raising that. You know, Ripple started doing a conference called Swell years ago in Toronto alongside Sibos at the time, and eventually we kind of spun it separate from that. But it really is intended to be one part a customer event for our various customers to talk about the various things they're doing with Ripple's technologies and Ripple solutions, but also to talk about where the industry is and, you know, even beyond where just Ripple is. And we have a number of speakers from outside of Ripple and our customers. I mean, we've had some amazing keynotes. Yeah, I'm back in Toronto. I remember Ben Bernanke, the former head of the Federal Reserve of the United States, spoke and I think talked about where he saw crypto and crypto going in the future. So it's always been, I think, very impactful. We've had speakers from around the world. It's a two-day event. We're holding it in Dubai in, I think, November 8th and 9th or 7th and 8th. I can't remember which.
Why Dubai?
By the way, thank you for asking that. We have done two or maybe just one in the United States. We've done Singapore, we've done Toronto, we've done London. It really is, frankly, if the U.S. is going to take a, frankly, hostile view towards these technologies, let's go to where customers and where governments are leading in. And certainly one of the strongest markets we have, as Ripple has as a company, and I think certainly Medico's done well as well, is in the Middle East. And so the interest in these technologies and the real world use cases, not just the speculation, have been quite high. So we chose Dubai probably a year ago, and I'm looking forward to being there. Hopefully we'll see some of the people in the audience today there as well. If you are interested, I know there's a website where you can register. I don't know exactly the URL, top of mind.
Well, I look forward to being there. I will be actually, Brad, I don't know if you're aware, but I will be taking one of the panels also. So we should probably be meeting there.
We definitely
will. Getting to the end of this discussion, is there anything that you would like to make as a final comment or question?
Well, you know, I'm going to take the liberty. There's one of the, I did cheat and peeked at the Q&A that had been posted. And there's a question that was posted that I really like because I think it's super fascinating. Terrence asked, do you see any value in the tokenization of intellectual property? I think this is one of the examples of a real world use case where tokenization really makes sense. And I've talked to CEOs of big pharma companies who talk about their patent portfolio and the value of the patent portfolio and how much complexity there is in the licensing of the patent portfolio, even cross pharma, and that they'll have hundreds of people and they still make tons of mistakes. And you think about if you could tokenize a patent in the pharma space and then build smart contracts within that so the licensing actually is auditable and you could actually track these things, it would improve efficiency. It would increase, I think, the value of those patents in various ways. And it would make them more accessible. And so I think it's a really good question, Terrence, and it's one that a patent is intellectual property. And so I think there's a lot of things like that have never been tokenized because it wasn't obvious how you could do it. And now, and even, cribbing from something Adrian said earlier, the technology exists. I think eventually that will happen. We can argue about is that 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, but I think it just makes sense.
Absolutely. You know, I see that there is a question relating to Switzerland, so I will take it. I feel it must be aimed at medical to some extent. So question is, where do you see traction geographically apart from Switzerland? So I'll start with the bad news, saying that Switzerland is not the best place where there is traction today. It was one of the first countries to put in place clarity in the regulatory framework, and therefore some of the early players, the early banks started in Switzerland maybe 5-6 years ago. But it's also a very conservative country, conservative in the sense that it's risk averse. It doesn't like change. It lacks safety. And therefore, past the first banks that had moved into this cryptocurrency and, Bitcoin and Ethereum trading, not much happened, frankly speaking. And so we were forced as a young startup 5 years ago to start looking outside of Switzerland. And the first jurisdictions that became attractive were in particular Singapore, Southeast Asia more widely, and Germany. And it remains some of the most attractive and prolific geographies for digital assets infrastructure in banking for a long time. Now the market has evolved a bit. France is catching up. Italy is catching up. Some countries in Africa, in particular South Africa, are starting to accelerate. The Middle East, as we discussed, with the UAE. In the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, it's also growing now more aggressively than it used to. I would say, unfortunately, the North American market, which had started to move in the last 2 or 3 years, has got to a point where it has become very difficult, in particular for banks, federally regulated banks, to do anything of significance. So they are all working on initiatives, they're all building capability, but they are not at a phase where they are able to operate at scale. And it feels a little bit frustrating because it's mostly related to the regulatory push against digital assets, to a point where even basically using a public ledger, even for tokens, even for nothing related to cryptocurrencies, public ledgers are not authorized within banking. And even things like using blockchain for books and records, say, well, okay, I'm going to use a private ledger to track my tokens. Can I use it? No, I still need to have a database managed by a transfer agent to tell me who owns what. And so it truly reduces the value of blockchain to less than a database to some extent in the current setup. So I may be exaggerating a bit. I think some banks have found interesting applications, in particular for use cases like bank-to-bank payments, etc. But it's not something which I would call very welcoming territory currently.
All right. Should we take any other questions here? I don't know. I know we're almost out of time, Adrian, so I'll let you be the guide.
Yeah, sure. So let me see if we have maybe a last one we can take. So, I mean, I think this is more of a high-level question. I'll give it to you, Brad. What are your thoughts on the Bitcoin's ETF approval and its future role in the monetary system?
So I think it is an interesting one. We've obviously seen a bunch of traditional financial firms file for spot Bitcoin ETFs. And finally, the United States SEC seems to be, after years of kind of dragging their feet, seems to be allowing those to move forward. I'm not sure, part of the question here is this idea that are they part of the, you know, the future monetary system. I mean, to me, a Bitcoin ETF is simply allowing people who may not know how to custody, buy, manage their crypto themselves to participate in Bitcoin as an asset. You know, it's a little like a gold ETF. You may not want to hold gold in your home, but being able to buy a gold ETF allows you investment exposure to that asset. And so I'm very much pro giving people access to these things in a way that works for them. And so I don't know why that would be bad and why the SEC was blocking that. Whether or not, you know, that has a role in the future monetary system, you know, as much as I'm bullish about Bitcoin and I own Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin has some significant limitations as it relates to a payments mechanism in terms of fees and speed. And so I'm not sure I see that as a transforming the monetary system.
Brad, it's been a great discussion. Thanks a lot and speak to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Adrian. Good to see you.